This is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, 91.3 KUAF. And this is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, March 13th, 2019, 6 minutes after 12. Ahead on our show, a new art walk in Siloam Springs. Art thrives away from the I-49 corridor as well, and we'll learn more in our second half hour. After our show on NPR's Here and Now, if you want to see the spirit of Chicago, just look up to its skyscrapers. The Windy City has long been recognized for the striking beauty of its buildings. A conversation with an architecture critic about the city's striking skyline. Here and Now, today at 1, right after Ozarks at Large on 91.3. And what can ancient times explain to us about contemporary challenges with climate change? Tonight, Ben Vining, assistant professor of anthropology, will deliver some clues in his talk, Archaeological Perspectives on Adapting to Climate Change, two examples from ancient Peru. The talk begins at 7 tonight at the Washington County Extension Office in Fayetteville. It's part of the celebration of Archaeology Month in Arkansas. It's free and open to the public. Voters in Fort Smith and Benton County are rejecting special election proposals to raise sales tax to fund projects in those areas. In Fort Smith, residents voted 65% to 35% against a 1% sales tax that would have gone toward completing the U.S. Marshals Museum. Of the 47,000 registered voters, 9,500 cast a ballot. The tax would have been in place for 9 months to raise the roughly $15 million needed to design and build the exhibit experience. Alice Holt, the vice president of development for the Marshals Museum Foundation, says they're grateful to have had the opportunity to put the proposal to a vote of the people.
The residents of Fort Smith are convicted and passionate about their causes. They are passionate about the museum, for sure. We heard this over and over again, that people were supportive of the museum, but what they weren't supportive of was a tax, which we also heard loud and clear.
Museum officials asked the Fort Smith Board of Directors for a special election after a large donation last summer that had been made a matching challenge fell through. From here, Alt says the Museum Foundation will continue fundraising.
Fundraising comes from, of course, all kinds of different donors, large and small. It comes from donors that have come with names that are well-known, of course, and it comes from those folks who help you build it brick by brick. So fundraising sources that we're talking to are donors that we've been courting for quite some time, and we will continue to do so.
So far, the Museum Foundation has raised about $35 million in donations and in-kind donations over the last decade. Construction on the $19 million building is underway, as that portion of the museum has been completely funded. Alt says the building and Hall of Honor will still be dedicated September 24th of this year, but at this point, she can't say when the museum will open to the public.
The tax not passing does push that open doors date. I'm not sure if it'll be summer-ish of 2020. It'll push that date for sure. We'll know more as we move forward with the current fundraising efforts that we have and those asks out to those donors.
Opponents of the proposal argued Fort Smith residents are already overtaxed with a sales tax rate of 9.75%. They also took issue with public tax money funding a private museum. Supporters say the museum will bring more than 125,000 visitors to Fort Smith and will have an annual impact of $13 to $22 million on the local economy. Meanwhile, voters in Benton County also are rejecting a sales tax increase. This one would have funded a new courthouse facility on the Bentonville Square. The results came back 62% to 38% against a 1/8-cent sales tax, which would have generated $25 million in addition to the $10 million set aside by the county. The new courthouse facility would have cost $30 million. The rest would have gone toward renovating the existing historic courthouse. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek this morning spoke with County Judge Barry Mooring about what happens from here.
How are you all feeling this morning knowing the outcome of yesterday's election?
First of all, you have to respect the process. This is the process that we live in. There's a reason why these kinds of proposals go to voters. Voters spoke. I absolutely respect the outcome. And so on the one hand, I'm disappointed. But on the other hand, you know, that was pretty clear direction that came in last night. We'll need to go back and reassess and determine what to do next.
So it seems like at this point, at least, the message from voters is no new sales tax for a new courthouse. So what does that mean for any future proposals that will have to be funded?
Well, that's one of the messages, but what I would caution there, if that's the way that we'll need to proceed is without a sales tax, then I would say the building doesn't build itself, and these are not inexpensive buildings. And without a sales tax, that would mean probably bonding a building and undertaking some pretty significant cuts to our budget to service a bond. And maybe that's the direction that we need to go. But along the way of servicing a bond, millions and millions of dollars and taxpayer dollars will be paid in interest. So there's no easy financial solution to this when you're looking at building a courts facility. And frankly, I believe that the proposal that was on the ballot yesterday will prove to be the least expensive facility to accomplish our needs. I think that the cost will only go up from here.
I know it's the day after the election and you will have to go back to the drawing board for a new plan, but any ideas being floated around at this point? Obviously, you will continue to use the facilities that you have now.
Yeah, and that's a real important point for Benton County citizens is court will continue to operate. And we have an excellent group of circuit court judges and their staff, the Benton County Sheriff's Office, our County Prosecutor's Office, our Public Defender's Office, the Benton County Circuit Court Clerk's Office. All of those offices do a remarkable job considering the facilities that they're forced to operate in. And that's how we'll continue for the indefinite future until another proposal or another idea is figured out. I don't think any solid proposals are existing today, but I also don't think there are any options that should be eliminated today either.
Leading up to this, you held a lot of town halls. The voters came back with a no. The sales tax played a big role, but anything else that you feel voters didn't respond to, perhaps, with this proposal?
Well, I think there were a few factors. I think there is a strong no new tax sentiment. That's going through Benton County and Northwest Arkansas. I mean, the Marshall's Museum got beat pretty resoundingly down in Fort Smith as well. So I think there's definitely that. I think the fact that this was coming at the same time that new tax proposals were coming out of the legislature didn't help matters. And then I think, you know, it's always been controversial as to where to put the new building. And, you know, we had strong consensus on the quorum court back in the spring of 2017 to put the new building downtown in downtown Bentonville in the county seat. But I think that going back and putting this proposal before voters brought that issue back up again. And that's been a divisive issue for two decades as to where to put that building.
So how long did it take to get to this point, to this vote on a new courthouse? Because that could be an indicator of how long it will take for any new proposal to get to a point like this one.
Yeah, I guess it depends on how far you want to look back to when it actually started. I mean, the voters turned down a courts facility back in the mid-90s, and people have been thinking about it ever since. But I would say going back to around the 2012 timeframe, it got very, very serious. And there were lots of different schematics and design options that came before the quorum court when I was a quorum court member, up and through the time that I've been the county judge. So I think there's been a good 6 to 7 years of pretty intensive study and consideration of the proposal that we ended up with last night. You know, and I guess it's kind of that old adage, if it were easy, it would have been done by now. This is not an easy solve. And so I think it's going to be a while before there's a practical proposal that comes back to voters.
That was Benton County Judge Barry Mooring speaking with Ozarks at Large's Susanna Sitek earlier today. Judge Mooring has said the new courthouse facility would have allowed the county to consolidate the courts scattered around the square and would have allowed for increased security. NWA Ballet Theater is launching a new dance initiative this spring called Dance Anywhere, Everywhere. The program includes outdoor and theater performances, a series of creative events for children, and social awareness events connecting artists with the community. The project is funded by a grant from the Walton Family Foundation worth nearly $106,000. Late last week, Thalia Madewell, project manager for NWA Ballet Theater, came to Studio 123 to speak with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda about the project. She began the conversation by discussing the history of the professional ballet company.
In 2011, Margie Bordofsky, Mariah Bordofsky, and the late Peggy Wallace started NWA Ballet Theater. They just noticed that there was a lot of dance talent in the region that was having to leave the area to either dance professionally or to attend professional performances. And so in response to that, they started NWA Ballet Theater. We're a nonprofit organization. They worked really hard to get that nonprofit status. And it's grown year by year. You know, for the first 3 or 4 years, we had predominantly local dancers, super talented dancers. And then in the past couple of years, under the direction of our new artistic director, Ryan Jolokernai, from Kansas City, we are now attracting talent from all over the United States. So that's kind of a little bit of the history, kind of segueing into where we are now. NWA Ballet Theater today employs 11 dancers. We have, I think it's six company dancers and 5 apprentices. And they are from everywhere, all corners of the United States, Florida, Arizona, New Jersey. We have a dancer from Oklahoma. And so I think our presence is being seen and felt and heard about. And it's audition season right now. We have auditions in a couple of weeks, and we have over 100 applicants so far to audition for us from all over the United States, and I think even 3 different countries that want to come dance with us. So just in that 7-8 years, we've gone from this very local, regional dance company to, I mean, we're really taking flight and being nationally and internationally seen.
And something that may help you continue to expand in the future is this new grant from the Walton Family Foundation.
Right.
It's going to support this initiative that you're launching or have launched.
Right.
Dance Anywhere, Everywhere.
Right. Yes. So we're very thankful to the Walton Family Foundation and their support of our effort. This grant is funds a six-month project. And the purpose of that project is to make dance visible in the area and to culminate an audience base. Sure, we want to grow financially. We want to gain more financial support, but we also want to gain more community support and grow that audience base. Just kind of developing a taste for dance in the region. It's not unnoticed that the arts are thriving in this area. But while we have a lot of visual arts and theater arts are well represented, the dance scene is kind of, there's not really been an umbrella for all of the amazing smaller organizations to come underneath and link arms with one another. And so we want to be that umbrella, be inclusive of all of the awesome dance that's going on around the region and spearhead that effort to make dance more visible and available for people to do, to participate in, and for people to enjoy and watch and appreciate.
Is it fair to say that maybe part of the issue of culminating more of a dance scene here mm-hmm. is perhaps people, audiences just aren't as aware of dance maybe as an art form or specifically an art form here in Northwest Arkansas?
Maybe. That may be it. And like I said, we want to develop that taste in our audience. And the project, Dance Anywhere, Everywhere, has 4 components. We like to refer to it easily as library, street, studio, stage. And so the first 3 of those are super audience accessible, non-ticketed dance events. And so starting with the library, you know, the cultivating our youngest art patrons. We are going to go into libraries in kids' own backyards on their turf where they feel comfortable and introduce the art form of dance to them through stories. And so there'll be some pantomiming activities. They'll be able to relate it to stories that they already know. And so that's where we're going to start. And then the street component of the project, Ryan likes to say that you might just see us pop up anywhere. And so that's very accessible. We want to be seen at festivals where people already are gathering and appreciating the cultural scape that is Northwest Arkansas. And Ryan has some really, really fun pieces that you cannot help but hear them and see them and start, you know, tapping your foot and getting into that. So that's our street component. It's called Dance Beat. And then our studio component is called Faces. And that is a really intimate kind of no walls, no barriers. We literally invite you into the studio that the dancers train in every single day. And Ryan conducts a rehearsal. We had a Faces event last night. We've just seen off our visiting choreographer, Jennifer Owen, from Owen Cox Dance Group. She set a piece on our company that will be part of our Dance Beat, the street component of the project. And we invited 40 to 50 of our neighbors in Northwest Arkansas to come sit and watch what we've been working on for the past 2 weeks. And the audience had a chance to ask questions of Jennifer and the experience that she brought in from her dance group, which is a modern dance group, got to ask Ryan questions, and they even got to ask the dancers questions. And afterward, we had a reception where our attendees got to mingle and really get to know the company. And we feel like that's important. And then we are going to culminate this project in June. The second week of June, we will be presenting a triple bill at Arend Arts Auditorium in Bentonville. And Jennifer Owen's piece will be included. We also have another choreographer visiting us in May, Gilmer Duran. He's a Venezuelan gentleman, and he will be working on a piece with our company that you'll be able to see at the Triple Bill in June. And Ryan will be choreographing two pieces as well. And so we feel like those four components kind of touch every sector of our community, and you can one of those components will fit your lifestyle. You know, we can meet you where you are with one of those things and then hope that we can build on that relationship and that you will continue to develop a taste for dance and it will become more of the natural landscape in the art landscape of Northwest Arkansas.
The arts are thriving, but what is the challenge with trying to grow a new art form? It's dance isn't new, but perhaps
right.
New to the area, that may be fair to say.
Right. I think the challenge that we, and I don't necessarily, I wouldn't call it a challenge, maybe the goal that we have with growing dance as an art form is really spreading our web wide and listening to other established arts organizations, community organizations, even municipalities, the cities, trying to fit into their already established dynamic. That's our goal, while simultaneously linking arms with our peer organizations that are also up and coming and trying to find their space in this arts community. So, I mean, a challenge, yes, but also a goal, you know, that this work we like doing, we love doing it.
Why is it important to you for the region to have multiple forms of art, particularly dance?
Particularly dance. Well, we are, as you probably know, an increasingly diverse community. And I think every sector of this population has something to offer artistically. And we would be doing a gross injustice if we didn't present that ourselves or invite others to present that in collaboration with us to represent all of the, sectors of the community that are in this bubble that is Northwest Arkansas.
So as this project develops, people can keep up with it at your website?
Yes, yes. We're on all the socials. Mm-hmm. So follow us on the socials, NWA Ballet Theater. We do dancer takeovers on Instagram regularly. So that's a fun perspective to watch. And then our website, nwaballettheater.org. We will be posting events there regularly and keeping people updated with what we're doing. So that's how to keep up with us.
Okay. Congratulations on the grant, and thank you for sharing
Antoinette.
Your story.
Yes, thank you for having me.
That was Thalia Madewell, project manager for NWA Ballet Theater. She spoke with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda at the Carver Center for Public Radio last week.
The 15th annual Valley of the Vapors Independent Music Festival is March 15th through the 18th. This event boasts 45 acts over 4 days in various locations within Hot Springs. Performers include Vertical Scratchers, Seamoya, Chastity, and others. Tickets and information are available online at valleyofthevapors.com. 91.3 is supported by the Walmart Museum, a family-friendly experience featuring interactive displays on the history of Walmart, Walton's Five and Dime, and the Spark Cafe Soda Fountain. Located on the square in downtown Bentonville, open daily until 9 p.m. Admission is free. 273-1329 or walmartmuseum.com.
If we were somehow suddenly transported about 1,600 years into the past, there wouldn't be many shared topics we could discuss with the people living in the year 300. Well, we could talk about Jesus, but we might be surprised how different the perception of Jesus then is from the perception of Jesus now. Linda Kuhn, professor of history and dean of the Honors College at the University of Arkansas, will discuss how Jesus was perceived in the Middle Ages as part of a preview of a book she's working on. Her talk, Dark Age Jesus, is part of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences Humanities Faculty Colloquium Series, and it will be given tomorrow at 4:30 in the Carnell Inn classroom on the University of Arkansas campus. This week, we invited Linda Kuhn to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. She says she's working on a subject that hasn't been given much attention.
The story of Jesus in the period 300 to 900 hasn't really been told. And Dark Age is a loaded term because, on the one hand, historians don't like it because it seems pejorative. But on the other hand, I actually really like it because, A, I've read the law codes from the time period. They are very dark. B, early medieval Jesus is kind of boring. So I put it together, and I'm calling it subversively Dark Age Jesus.
Okay. You know, I think for many of us who might have grown up in a church in the 1970s or 80s, we kind of have one Jesus in mind. You know, our Jesus doesn't stretch back a couple thousand years, really. And so there is, depending on your religious affiliation when you grew up, there is this one sort of narrative. But his story has morphed over time?
Absolutely. I would say that's the beauty of studying Jesus. And there haven't been that many great books on the subject taking it over a huge time period because it's super difficult. But I would say that the nice thing about Jesus is that the human savior is always in that narrative. But in different time periods, the way in which Jesus is treated sort of waxes and wanes. It shifts all the time. And so I'm doing a period that traditionally is seen as not really having a cult to a suffering human savior, but rather a much more remote God as judge, apocalyptic deity that somehow the human figure of Jesus is downplayed during this time period because of the nature of the culture that's converted to Christianity. Doesn't have that emotional savior, that intensely human suffering savior, which appears to be characteristic of a later medieval period and not this time period.
So does that mean that there
not human, more supernatural? Or?
Yes. Remote, judge, apocalyptic, emotionless. You know, part of this is, in theory, we're dealing with barbarian cultures, another problematic term.
Right.
But somehow that they didn't have the emotional sophistication to embrace that kind of human suffering character that becomes so much more important in the later period of the history of Christianity.
On one hand, I guess it would make sense that one of the constant figures in humanity for a couple of millennia would go through some shifts in
Absolutely.
How people have viewed
Absolutely.
This
and in fact, this is the great subject for a huge book because Jesus, the human figure versus Christ, right, that's the theological character. So that I think a lot of people don't make that distinction,
right.
Almost as if Christ is a last name for Jesus or, you know.
Right, right.
But they're really very distinctive characters of the same deity, right? But theologically speaking, Christ has a more stable persona in a way. It's the human part that consistently fluctuates. And that's true in the history of America. Even more famously, my Americanist colleagues tell me a book that came out in the turn of the 20th century in which Jesus is sort of imagined as a banker.
As a banker?
Yeah, sure. I would say Jesus is constantly being remade in our culture. Yeah.
So
depending upon the sort of current ideologies of the time, they sort of remake this image. And that's true. We might think Jesus is stable in American culture, but it's probably not true.
Right. What is the earliest that for your book project you're looking at Jesus?
300.
Relatively new idea at the time, right? Or a relatively new figure.
Right.
Just
Absolutely.
A few hundred years old.
Yes.
How much can you find out about what people thought of Jesus or thought of his influence so many years ago?
Well, I use a lot of visual evidence. So architectural, artistic, even objects. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a very, well, I wouldn't say it's famous. It's famous in archaeological circles. There is a bloodstone amulet from, appears to be late Roman Syria, about the year 200, in which there's a figure of a crucified man. Now, he's tied to the cross, which is one way the Romans did crucify. It's not always the nails, as the Gospel of John tells us so in detail. Mm-hmm. But this image is surrounded by magical texts, and it basically does invoke the name Jesus, Yahweh, great satrap, and a whole series of other what we might call magical incantations. And it appears to be the case, it's the kind of amulet women would have worn, especially when they were pregnant. Because even as early as the 3rd century, there's some idea that the suffering human savior and the blood had some, you know, I'd say magical, but let's say fertility ramifications. So I use a lot of objects, text. Now, when you're in the late Roman Empire, you're in the world of the church fathers. So you've got lots of things about theology, the relationship between the Son and the Father, the human Jesus. But it's when you get into my time period, which is really 300 to 900, the stereotype is that theological complexity goes away.
Right.
And foregrounding a cosmological deity and kind of losing sight of a suffering savior until about the 11th century, that's pretty precise, but it's true. You know, in the history of Jesus, usually the period 300 to 1000 is skipped over.
I know that there have been objects found in Iceland that when Lutherans were coming in and they wanted to convert the population from, you know, what we would call mythological beliefs. There are figures that are thought to be representing both Thor and Jesus to kind of make the transition easy. Is part of this, for lack of a less crass word, marketing?
That's not crass. That's what my book's about.
Oh, okay.
It's hard to market the crucifixion, right? Especially in the Roman Empire. I mean, think about it. This is how Romans executed the worst kind of political offenders. Not thieves, not ordinary people. For one thing, crucifixion is kind of expensive. Mm. It requires a lot of labor and parade and et cetera, et cetera. And it requires the military, so you don't just crucify people willy-nilly.
Gotcha.
But it wouldn't be necessarily a symbol that would have been easy to market. And that's part of my story, is how did they market crucifixion to the Roman Empire? And there are a lot of different ways of doing that. But if you look at that Jesus as the remote cosmological figure, often the kind of tree of life, I mean, he almost looks like he's a tree. That works really great in northern Germany and Scandinavia, where you have the cult of Yggdrasil and all of those sort of tree deities. So, yeah, you can market the flexibility of the figure of Jesus can be recreated to create to fit a particular market. That's smart. Yes. Very good.
You mentioned he was, especially in early, heroic. Muscular? I mean, did...
Oh, yes.
Which is not how we necessarily...
I wish I could show him to you, because he's obviously the ideal of manly beauty in the Carolingian court in this one image. Although muscular Christianity, a very Victorian
right.
occupation. So again, Jesus can go through these different gender fluctuations. He's a very flexible, sacred character.
Are you able to see things that are happening adjacent to the change in his image, like politically or in power?
Absolutely. I do think that that one image of Jesus that was created in the Carolingian court says a lot about that particular court. It lauded itself for its very stable masculinity, which is basically built upon a whole series of warrior images. And he fits nicely into that. And in fact, the Carolingians in the 830s, monks created a series of poems that depict Jesus and the apostles as a warlord and his warriors. Mm. And it's poetry, see? So there is a great example, but I wouldn't say it's the only example of Jesus. That's kind of the stereotype, that it becomes part of this Germanic militaristic culture, et cetera, right? Royal figure, remote, cosmological, like the emperor. But there's a lot of other things out there, too.
What is the value for those of us, lay people, not historians, knowing that there has been a change in the Middle Ages or even in American history in this incredibly important figure?
Well, I think it's really important from a large perspective of the history of religion to understand that while some theological meaning is somewhat stable, there are things in Christianity that are super stable, theologically speaking. But the practice of religion drives a lot of what religion really is. And so when you think about that, you would imagine that a 9th century Carolingian court and its practice of the religion, while there are stable theological and even liturgical aspects, is going to project their culture onto a human figure. It makes sense. And so I'm glad that Dark Age Jesus is Dark Age Jesus. And I'm interested in Jesus in the 21st century, but I don't want him to be stable.
Dr. Linda Kuhn is a professor of history and dean of the Honors College at the University of Arkansas. She'll deliver the talk, Dark Age Jesus, tomorrow afternoon at 4:30 as part of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences Humanities Faculty Colloquium Series. This will take place in the Carnell Inn classroom on the University of Arkansas campus. This is Ozarks at Large.
This is Reflections in Black, and I'm your host, Raven Cook. Reflections in Black is a segment dedicated to exploring the legacy of Black Americans in the United States and around the globe. Reflections in Black also provides resources for understanding and hope for all people. Born on June 29, 1941, in Trinidad and Tobago, Stokely Carmichael exploded on the scene in the late 1960s, introducing the larger world to the term and concept Black Power. In 1952, Stokely Carmichael joined his parents Adolphus and Mabel Carmichael in Harlem, New York, after they immigrated to the United States. And in 1954, he himself would become a naturalized citizen. He graduated from the elite Bronx High School of Science in 1960 and then entered Howard University in D.C., studying philosophy. Galvanized by the energy of the sit-in demonstrations happening throughout the country, Carmichael joined the movement and became a freedom rider in 1961. While acting as a freedom rider, Carmichael would be arrested and sent to Parchman Prison in Mississippi, and would apply the tactics of nonviolence. After being released from prison, he would continue his work in organizing and mobilizing Black Americans for change. serving in major campaigns like Freedom Summer and the early movements of SNCC, or the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. In 1966, Carmichael would take a leadership role as chairman of SNCC after the tenure of John Lewis. The period was critical. Many of the organizers had grown weary of the movement and the United States political system at large, including Carmichael. But a radical ideology of Black power would provide new hope to Black America and a new energy to the civil rights movement. In the summer of 1966, leaders from all major civil rights organizations would travel to Mississippi to continue a march called A Walk Against Fear, begun by James Meredith, a leader in the fight for school integration. Carmichael would be joined by titans of the movement, particularly Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Throughout the day of June 16, 1966, SNCC organizers had begun encouraging people to use the phrase Black power. And that warm Mississippi evening, Carmichael yelled to the crowd, "We've been saying freedom for 6 years. What we are going to start saying is Black power." A cadence of Black power echoed through the crowd, eventually through the United States and around the world. But Black power as a concept then had to be defined. And this would lead to the text, Black Power, the Politics of Liberation, in 1968, which he wrote with Charles V. Hamilton. Stokely Carmichael would continue building the concept of Black Power, traveling around the world and speaking to leaders in African, Asian, and South American countries. He would also become an outspoken critic of the war in Vietnam and actively participate in the anti-war demonstrations of the day. As an organizer, he would work on the Loudoun County Freedom Party in Alabama, helping mobilize Black Americans to register to vote, and even worked for a brief time with the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. Paying homage to African leaders Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana and Sékou Touré of Guinea, Carmichael would rename himself Kwame Touré. A hero and critical figure in helping Black Americans see the beauty in themselves and translate that into political power, Kwame Ture's triumphant life would end in 1988 as he lost his battle with prostate cancer at the age of 57. Nevertheless, we celebrate the incredible life, legacy, and memory of the inspiring, the revolutionary, the liberating Kwame Ture, or Stokely Carmichael.
Reflections in Black is a production of KUAF Public Radio. You can hear weekly segments on Ozarks at Large, and you can learn more about the series online at KUAF.com/reflections-black.
And now we are inside the Harold and Blanche Cox News Studio. Time to take a look at live music coming our way with Timothy Dennis. Timothy, what do we got?
We've got a lot. Let's start with tonight. Lucero returns to Fayetteville.
Going to be at George's, right?
Going to be at George's. If you're not familiar, just a great old rock and roll band.
Yep.
Opening that show will be Jamie Lou and the Hall of Blue.
Friends of the show.
Tickets for that show tonight are $25. It'll get underway at about 8:30. Again, that's at George's in Fayetteville. Moving on to tomorrow night, Thursday, is the next On the Map show. Takes place at Smoke and Barrel Tavern. This time is kind of electro-pop rock and roll featuring Dead Rider, Locate S1, and Ankle Pop.
Ah.
You used to run, run, you used to ride. You used to hit, hit, and scream. Now you're flat, hearted, hearted. Remote control, guidance system, algorithm. Target engaged. Oh yes, I made you a kid on a screen.
That show has an $8 cover in advance, $10 at the door. Gets underway at about 9 o'clock tomorrow night, again at Smoke and Barrel in Fayetteville. Also happening tomorrow night, but down in Fort Smith, Whispering Willows will be at Harry's Downtown.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic folk Americana duo from Eureka Springs.
Flowers in my hair. to make troubles walk on song. But your heart can overcome.
That show at Harry's has a $5 cover set to get underway at about 8 o'clock tomorrow night. Moving forward to Friday, there's going to be a show featuring Tulsans at George's Majestic Lounge, Henna Rosso, which is kind of a musical collective, and Branjay is going to be there.
Oh, fun.
If you're not aware, she's from the group Count Tutu. She's right. Doing her own thing now that features electronic R&B, funk, kind of all rolled up into one.
I can tell something's wrong.
Show at George's Friday night has a $10 cover set to get underway at about 9 o'clock. Also happening Friday night, Black Apple Crossing is going to have a band kind of from your neck of the woods, actually, from Mountain Home.
Well, that is my neck of the woods.
They're an alt-rock band by the name of Patient Eyes.
All right.
Times red like blood. I sit here backseat of this car, hard to steer. It's raining hard, thunder boom, whispering an impending doom, and the known is coming soon.
That show at Black Apple Crossing gets underway at about 8 o'clock Friday night. Also happening Friday night over in Eureka Springs, Chelsea's is going to have Two Shock, which it started out as a local duo but of Travis Smith and John Shorter, but they recently added more members including Garrett Brolin, Colin Littlejohn, and Michael Hanna. This show at Chelsea's is going to be an 80s versus 90s party.
80s versus 90s, so what do
costumes,
you think?
Costumes, like 80s and 90s music, like...
Okay.
Just be prepared for a party, okay. Is what it sounds
all
like.
Right.
That show at Chelsea's has a $5 cover, gets underway at about 9:30. Again, that's Friday night. Also happening Friday night down in Fort Smith, Hosty returns to the area.
Nice.
He's going to be at Harry's downtown.
Cuidado.
That show at Harry's will cost you $5, gets underway at about 9 o'clock.
Harry's never has a big cover charge. A lot of great music there for not much money.
Big music for little money is how I like to think
of
it. Let's move on to Saturday night. A show happening at George's that you talked about last week on the show.
The Pogs, their reunion show.
Yeah, it's a big reunion. They haven't played together for how many years?
Gosh, I think they hadn't played officially together for 7 or 8.
Oh, dang.
Yeah.
That's quite a long time apart. They're also going to feature on that bill Will Brand and the Rubber Band.
Will Brand also in the Pogs.
Exactly.
But this is going to be just a fun show.
$10 cover, gets underway at about 9 o'clock. Again, that's Saturday night at George's in Fayetteville. Also happening in Fayetteville Saturday night, a guy I'm not going to spend much time on today because we're going to spend a lot of time on him Friday, Royal Wade Kimes is going to be at Sunrise Stage.
A great storyteller, great musician, great singer, and we're going to hear plenty from him on Friday's show.
Yes. Tickets for that show at Sunrise Stage are $22, gets underway at about 7 o'clock Saturday night. Also happening Saturday night, but moving up to Bentonville, Gouda is going to be at Bike Rack Brewing Company.
Another one of their listening sessions.
Yes. They're kind of rock with a smorgasbord of other influences thrown in.
Yeah.
Entities roam, and all entities roam. Can't feel my poison ivy. I
don't sleep. I'm not doing so well. I'm so in love, I am sneaking.
That show has a $10 cover. It's limited seating again because it is a brew room show.
Right.
And it'll get underway at about 7 o'clock again. That's Saturday night, Bike Rack Brewing Company in Bentonville. Also happening Saturday night, Candy Lee will be at Brick Street Brews in Rogers.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Solo show?
Yeah, solo show. Okay. Fantastic folk Americana music. That show gets underway at about 7 o'clock. Again, that's Brick Street Brews in Rogers. Then over at Chelsea's in Eureka Springs, Red Oak Ruse returns. That show gets underway at about 9 o'clock. And then finally Saturday night, Jesse Dean and company will be at Warren's Rec Room in Alma.
Ooh, that's a nice
listening
venue.
Room type
yeah.
venue.
Right.
Jesse Dean is kind of a rockin' blues artist, originally from Winslow. That show at Warren's has an $8 cover, set to get underway at about 7 o'clock Saturday night. Then finally, for your St. Patrick's Day celebration.
Well, that's right. Sunday is St. Patty's Day.
George's in Fayetteville is going to have the 1 ounce jig and Monk is King. So
that'll
plenty
fun
of
show.
Funk to get your St.
Yes.
Patty's Day blues out of the way. That show has an $8 cover, gets underway at about 9 o'clock.
Well, happy early St. Patrick's Day to you, Timothy.
Happy early St. Patrick's Day to you, Kyle.
All right. We do this almost every week. We won't do it next week, however.
Correct.
Because we won't have new material a week for Wednesday. So you're on your own for next week, but we'll be back with you in a couple weeks to do this.
Yes, we will.
This is Ozarks at Large. The inaugural Art at the Springs Art Walk in downtown Siloam Springs will begin tomorrow evening at 5. LaKay Daly is founder and coordinator for this latest art event in the region. Following similar events in cities along the I-49 corridor, LaKay, an artist who moved to Siloam Springs a couple of years ago, says she thought it was time for Siloam Springs to shine.
And then I started going to the art walks in Rogers, and then I started participating in them as an artist. And I said to myself, you know, we really need something like that here. Siloam Springs has such a charming downtown, and we are in a prime position to embrace the arts that's paying its way across Northwest Arkansas.
She began coordinating with business owners and artists and says the response was enthusiastic and rapid. Many of the host businesses tomorrow night, like Ivory Bill Brewing Company, Tinto's and Tapas, and the Park House, share something with this inaugural art walk. They're relatively recent additions to downtown. LaKay Daly says she thinks it all adds up to reasons for locals to come out, but for people outside of Siloam to drive over as well.
Many of the people that I've talked to up around Northwest Arkansas have never been to Siloam Springs, but once they go there, they fall in love with it. We have such a charming downtown, and we have the room to bring in so much art culture. We're getting a municipal park with an amp this summer. I believe it's opening up in May. So that will be good for the art community as well.
She began coordinating with business owners and artists and says the response was enthusiastic and rapid. Many of the host businesses tomorrow night, like Ivory Bill Brewing Company, Tinto's and Tapas, and the Park House, share something with this inaugural art walk. They're relatively recent additions to downtown. LaKay Daly says she thinks it all adds up to reasons for locals to come out, but for people outside of Siloam to drive over as well.
And they are Alan Morgan. He is going to be showing at the Iberville Brewing Company. John Daly will be at Pure Joy Ice Cream. Jamie Clayburgh will be at Tintas and Tapas. Serena May will be at Baytopia. Joanne Reed will be at Occasions. And Joanne Holly and Jay Von Koffer will be at the Park House Kitchen and Bar. And they're all very talented artists. A couple of them are also musicians, so they may be playing some music in future art walks as well.
LaKay Daly is founder and coordinator of the inaugural Art at the Springs Art Walk in downtown Siloam Springs, taking place tomorrow evening from 5 to 8. After not increasing tuition for 7 years, the Northwest Arkansas Community College Board of Trustees approved a tuition hike at their meeting this week. Students who reside in the taxable area of the Rogers and Bentonville school districts are not included. They will continue to pay $75 per credit hour. The out-of-district tuition rate will go up by $12.50 to $135 per credit hour. Out-of-state students will have to pay $150 per credit hour instead of $125. And international students will see an increase from $175 to $195. The increases will start this fall and are expected to bring in more than $1 million in revenue. According to a statement from NWAC, the majority of that will support technical and professional programs, as well as minimal salary increases for faculty and staff. The statement also reads that the school has been frugal and committed to continuing to provide quality, accessible education at an affordable cost to all students.
Opera Fayetteville presents Dark Sisters in the Star Theater at Walton Arts Center March 29th and 30th. Nico Muley's acclaimed opera tells the story of Eliza, a woman who begins to question her life in a polygamous sect, starring mezzo-soprano Margaret Newcomb and accompanied by the Opera Fayetteville Orchestra. OperaFayetteville.org for tickets and information.
Contributors this Wednesday to our show included Antoinette Grajeda, Zuzana Sitek, and Timothy Dennis. Timothy also mastered our show. Reflections in Black, written and hosted by Raven Cook, produced by Lee Wood at KUAF. The music you hear at the end of many of our shows, curated by Antoinette. A listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Moffett, Oklahoma. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. We'll end with music from Chucky Wags, recorded for us in the Carver Center for Public Radio. He'll be at Smoke and Barrel Friday night at 9. You can find out more about Chucky at ChuckyWags.com. This is his song, Dancing Shoes. Thanks for listening. We're back tomorrow at noon and 7. Broken heart. Don't you know he sets him up and I come back just the same. He knows how to ease my pain some way, somehow. And I don't gotta be here, I could go anywhere, you see. But this is where I wanna be, right here, right now. So I'll tell them girls to put on them dancing shoes. Tell the band to start playing the blues. Tell the man to shuffling cards. Tell me when they start, bartender, what have you got for a broken heart? Until last call. And everyone's got troubles, and that's why we're all right here. Plus whiskey and the beer. You know it ain't so bad after all, man, it ain't so bad. So just tell them girls to put on them dancing shoes. Tell the band to start playing the blues. Tell the man to shuffling cards. Tell me when they start, bartender, what have you got? Yeah, what have you got? How's about just one more shot?